Your film is now ready to be shown.
Good morning. I'm Justin Hendricks, editor of Tech Policy Press, a nonprofit media venture intended to provoke new ideas, debate, and discussion at the intersection of technology and democracy. If you've been reading Tech Policy Press closely over the last 3 weeks, you may have come across one or more posts from a collaboration with Data and Society called Ideologies of Control, a series on tech power and democratic crisis. The articles in the series examine how powerful tech billionaires and authoritarian leaders and thinkers are leveraging AI and digital infrastructure to advance anti-democratic agendas, consolidate control, and reshape society in ways that threaten privacy, labor rights, environmental sustainability, and democratic governance. For this episode, I spoke to four of the authors who made contributions to the series. Let's get right into it.
I'm Jacob Metcalf. I am the program director of the AI on the Ground Initiative at Data and Society.
I am Tamara Nees, and I am program director of the Climate Technology and Justice Program at Data and Society.
I'm Reem Suleiman. I am the outgoing U.S. advocacy lead at the Mozilla Foundation, and I have been on the City of Oakland's Privacy Advisory Commission for almost a decade, but officially termed out.
I'm Kevin DeLibon. I'm the president and founder of Tectonic Justice.
I'm excited to have the four of you join me today. We're going to offer a kind of smorgasbord, a sampler platter of some of the themes and topics that we've addressed together in this series that Data and Society brought to Tech Policy Press over the last couple of weeks. Jacob, where did this idea come from, and what did you hope to accomplish when you set out to bring these more than a dozen writers together earlier this year?
With the inauguration of the second Trump administration earlier in the year, we started seeing just radical transformations around how the U.S. government operates and how we're speaking about democracy publicly, the rate of change with technology within the government, right? And in particular, this new sort of cohesion around the power of tech oligarchs and a increasingly authoritarian government that seems to want to centralize as much power as possible under the executive branch, that is heavily invested in surveillance and going after perceived political and personal enemies of the president and other members of the executive branch. And this sort of rapid joining at the hip of the very powerful tech oligarchs centered around the AI industry in particular, and the second Trump administration poses a crisis of democracy. It's changing the conditions under which citizens can participate within self-governance. It's changing the conditions under which we can lead economically successful lives, take care of our families. It's changing the conditions under which we can speak, express ourselves, participate in civic life, right? And it's all coming under the conditions of rapid technological change. So these really are, you know, in a lot of ways, rapid technological change and the shift in how we perceive the U.S. federal government in particular. Those go hand in hand. They are not separate issues. And, you know, as we've gotten together with our friends and colleagues over those couple months early in the administration, especially when DOGE was kicking off, that's a shock and awe campaign from the Trump administration, but it wasn't a surprise to most of us. If you've been paying attention closely to the ideologies at play in the tech industry for the past decade, not a surprise. This is what they've wanted. And they've been quite clear about it on their blogs, in their forums, at their conferences. You know, the core thinkers of the tech right, like Curtis Yarvin, Nick Land, you know, I hate to call Mark Andreessen a thinker, but he at least is highly influential. And they'll tell you what they think. And they've been telling you what they think for a couple decades. It's anti-democracy. It's anti-civil society. It's anti-journalism. It's anti-truth. And it's all about accumulating power so that they can enforce a very peculiar, often sci-fi inflected view of the future of humanity, right? They want to essentially inflict that upon us. And they see within the rise of AI an opportunity to do so. AI allows them to centralize command and control over our behavior, over our economy, over what we're allowed to think, over our culture, in a way that is remarkable to them. And they see it as a chance to accelerate a regressive social change. And if you've been paying attention to them, you could see. But trying to explain something like the network state, which Gilderon does so ably, including with an entry in the series, explain something like the network state to, you know, your cousin or your friend from high school, even sometimes your well-informed colleagues, right? Like a lot of my colleagues at Data Society hadn't heard of the network state until, you know, we tried to steal Greenland. These explanatory nuggets are out there. We wanted to take the time to create a resource that would essentially explain the role that these ideologies are playing in this rapid change. You know, that silly little arguments from Twitter between tech oligarchs about the nature of AI that only a few people were paying attention to critically are now central to the question of how does the US government operate? Like arguments from the dorms at Stanford in 1990 are now central to how the US government operates, and everyone needs to be able to see it. Now, we don't need to know every single detail about those arguments. The point is, that's not how government should run, right? That's not democracy. That's no sane way to run a functioning government. And we shouldn't stand for it. And so we're trying to build out a resource. This is, you know, sort of the first step targeted at, you know, readers of Tech Policy Press, which is, you know, obviously our peers, well-informed folks. But nonetheless, we're trying to make a resource that's accessible, that's about the ideologies, the ideas, the concept, the narratives behind this rapid change that is harming so many Americans and so many people around the world.
And you write in your introduction to the series, a kind of framing piece with Meg Young, that correctly diagnosing today's crisis depends on seeing behind the popular rhetoric about AI and government toward understanding who benefits from these narrative frames and the changes to the distribution of power that they make possible. I think that's a good place to come to you, Kevin, because that's, you know, in many ways where your piece picks up. You have this post called Austerity Intelligence. What's it about?
Yeah, well, we're really focusing on the ways that AI is eroding the material stability that folks need to participate meaningfully in democracy. We know there are a ton of threats around AI to democracy, right? We know about the mis and disinformation that's been rampant in campaigns. We know about the possibility to like expunge voter rolls and various other things. We know about its role in helping the Trump administration take over the instruments of government and then go and abduct people off the street, basically using AI. But one thing we haven't focused on so much is this notion that like, hey, to participate meaningfully in democracy, you have to have time, you have to have energy, you have to have money, right? And that's for all kinds of participation. Certainly voting, but what about going to your local school board meeting or your local city council meeting? You need childcare. You need a chance to learn about issues. You need some time to get together with other people. All of these things that kind of comprise the full spectrum of democratic participation require resources. Lives of many people are already pretty unstable, right? There are many of us that if not are outright poor under the poverty line, we're within like seeing distance of it. And even if you're not there, you know, there are all sorts of statistics about the number of Americans who couldn't survive like one lost paycheck without missing meals or other things. So there's just like, we just don't have much stability. And it's really hard to participate in democracy when you don't have stability. And now AI is coming in and it's making these decisions about all aspects of our lives, whether or not you qualify for Medicaid or other sorts of public benefits, what job you might be able to get and under what conditions you're working and how much you're making, where you can live and again, under the conditions, how your kids are getting educated in schools. And when AI is used to make these decisions, it's almost universally harmful. It's not expanding access. It's not making benefits easier to get or jobs or housing easier to get. It's the opposite. And so my piece is trying to look at that connection and showing how AI is intensifying the existing precarity and instability that folks face, particularly low-income people who are a vital part of our democracy. And even if you're not yourself low-income, you should know, too, that AI is coming for you, right? There are ever more articles about how there was one a couple weeks ago in the New York Times, I think, how Amazon programmers who had programmed a lot of the so-called bossware that kind of dictates how warehouse workers work are now having the same kinds of expectations applied to them in their own programming. And many of them don't like it. And it's just an example of how, hey, this technology might be deployed upon and experimented on low-income people or people who are otherwise vulnerable, but really it's coming for everybody. And it's only going to make our material lives worse. And if that happens, how are we going to band together? How are we going to participate meaningfully in democracy along that full spectrum?
And I'll just quickly ask you to maybe point to a couple of the ideas that you have in the piece. You suggest various ways we could perhaps invigorate democracy despite the fact that AI is being used to undermine it.
Yeah, 100%. So I think first we have to survive it, right? So we have to help each other with our material conditions, which means investing in frontline advocates in the legal aid world. These are attorneys who can provide free legal representation to low-income folks. I was one for a dozen years. Social services, mutual aid organizations, like helping people just kind of survive, I think is the first step and show up for each other. We then have to talk about AI is an illegitimate way of making decisions about these key aspects of life. Like, we just can't accept the premise either that it's inevitable or that it's appropriate to use these kinds of technologies. I think we have to do that. And then we have to also capitalize on this awful, awful moment. But people are feeling the pain of AI in a very tangible way, whether they know it or not, right? Like, all the folks laid off from the federal government, much of that was driven by some sort of AI. It might have been relatively unsophisticated and basically a control F search function that's on steroids, but it was something that's touching people's material lives, that's related to AI, that's related to big tech, that's related to these overarching themes that Jacob referenced just a second ago. And so if we can help people understand, hey, AI is harming my life in a very real way, we might be able to engage people in kind of a bigger, broader movement-based reckoning with the technologies that's also tied to political revival. And so that's where I think a lot of the hope is here is in all the harm that people are feeling, there's the basis to connect that to the larger political struggle.
Reem, I'll come to you next. Your piece along with Esra and Brian is really focused perhaps on one of the more urgent sets of questions that come out of this moment around the frightening combination of data that we're seeing happen in the federal government and the fear, of course, that that same federal government might come for data sets that are held by other governments in the United States at the state, at the local level. You suggest essentially a kind of triage for communities and cities and towns across the country that want to protect their citizens from an increasingly authoritarian reach of a federal government. Tell me about this. What were you hoping to accomplish in this piece?
I think one of my goals was to, one, you know, it's better to come late to the party than not at all in terms of privacy. But in a lot of ways, this is a new and old problem. You know, we're talking about AI now, but part of the reason none of this feels like a surprise to me and other privacy advocates is informed by how the federal government has dealt with other forms of technology in the past, like automated systems that Kevin mentioned, but also facial recognition or the other bazillion types of surveillance tech that, you know, law enforcement agencies routinely purchase. And that's expanded largely under both Democratic and Republican administrations with very little safeguards or any thought as to what the implications might be for the future and what we trade off as a society. So I think, you know, the goal for me is really for folks to understand the importance of scrutinizing public-private sector contracts, whether that's surveillance tech, AI, or otherwise, in both good and bad times, air quotes. You know, because they're obviously the big tech oligarchs that we're thinking about and get discussed in this piece, but there are also many smaller tech contractors and these, you know, private contracts that the public sector adopts. They're actually a huge part of the economy, and especially those used in defense and the criminal justice system or with law enforcement. So, you know, the work of myself and my co-authors in the series and in our career has really been focused on the question of how do you future-proof things so that people aren't vulnerable to mission creep, like your data gets collected under one pretense and then repurposed for another down the line that you're not okay with, or worse, as we're seeing right now, with dangerous political winds and what's happening right now in California with the ICE RAIDS is a really important example of why it's important for people to think about privacy, ideally in preventative measures, but our piece is thinking about how to triage now that, you know, we have a crisis at our door.
And you've given us three levels of consideration. Can you just quickly walk us through this?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, it's levels in terms of urgency and order of things. Like, obviously, if you're in a place like Flint or one of the other few cities that has thought a little bit about creating, you know, accountability mechanisms when it comes to privacy, you may be in a different situation. But, you know, I think the first order of business that we encourage people to think about is thinking about what data they actually collect and which of that is sensitive and most sensitive, because, you know, if and when the federal government comes knocking at your door, you want to make sure that you're not holding on to things that are particularly sensitive unnecessarily, right? So doing an inventory to just understand what you have and what's most vulnerable is important. And, you know, I think our general rule of thumb is don't keep anything longer. Only keep what you need and for no longer than you need it for. And then be very, very diligent about sticking to strict retention schedules. And then, you know, in terms of the next order of business, we talk a little bit about, you know, other sorts of data sharing agreements that might exist between cities and federal agencies. And, you know, one thing that may be a model, you know, there are cities like San Francisco and Oakland and others that have chosen to abandon certain partnerships because of, you know, differences in terms of how federal agencies may approach things like racial profiling, right? And so there, in Oakland, for example, you know, we have a couple of different ordinances that get to this question. One that sets, you know, transparency for, you know, these kinds of participation in federal task forces. But then we also have one related to our sanctuary city ordinance that essentially prohibits the city of Oakland from contracting with companies that also contract with ICE for data collection or immigration detention. So these are sorts of things and considerations that cities can start to have. And the last bucket here is, you know, just having an open process when it comes to your public contracts. Because I think one thing that we've seen in our work with the city of Oakland is when we have an open process and you have vendors competing, you are more likely to get them to meet your terms and give you a privacy preserving option versus just going with the first, you know, person who gives you a shiny pitch. I think that is a really important thing to formalize and just make part of the culture of a city.
Tamara, I want to bring you in here because your piece kind of addresses the root infrastructure for artificial intelligence and a lot of the things that we're talking about in these more immediate sort of circumstances. You're kind of asking the question about AI infrastructure, data center development, energy requirements of AI generally, such an extraordinary thing that we're witnessing. Like, I think if you stand up on the moon and you look down and you sort of ask what that species down there is doing, it looks like they're building concrete boxes all over the planet and figuring out how to power them and run water to them, that sort of thing. Tell me a little bit about your goals with this piece. Why are tech oligarchs so obsessed with energy, and what does that mean for democracy?
Yeah, well, I feel like it, as a piece, is very much trying to bring together the kind of science fiction, future-oriented inflection that Jacob mentioned at the top of our conversation. So thinking about the tech oligarchs like Sam Altman, who are pushing forward not only a vision of AGI or artificial general intelligence, where AI can either meet or potentially surpass human cognition, but also thinking about technologies that don't quite exist yet, like nuclear fusion, and imagining that the future will be one dominated by both AI and tech oligarch control of energy and energy infrastructure. But juxtaposing that with the communities on the ground who are very much already dealing with the impacts of these data center buildouts, thinking about the kinds of vulnerable communities that both Kevin and Reem are talking about. And I think Reem's point about the need for local participation, like having the public be part of the process, is one way that we could potentially push back against this dream of essentially putting a data center in every county, putting a data center on the moon, putting a data center in the desert, and any number of other terrible ideas that are beginning to bubble to the surface. The other purpose of this particular piece was to connect this idea of the network state, which is another one of those very lofty kinds of scary ideas that Gil Duran has done such an amazing job of writing about publicly, but really bringing it down to the fact that these ideologies are beginning to have impacts at the local level. And so the formation of a kind of network city, the rumored Tenderloin building that is meant to be a network state playland that multiple people in the Bay Area keep telling me about, but I have not yet seen. I think the idea that these lofty ideas, these ideologies do find inroads in actual real estate, in actual towns, and data centers become another kind of instantiation of the kind of power that tech companies and their particular vision for the future can have over people without their consent, or even in many cases without their full knowledge.
You know, you talk a little bit about various options that people are pursuing right now, including nuclear, the arguments that folks are making around fusion, all of the kind of investment and energy that's going into startups that are trying to address various infrastructure problems. I don't know, you were studying this closely. You're studying also how communities are reacting. Do you think we're just in a moment right now where these data centers are a particular threat environmentally, or should we believe what we're being told by industry that these are addressable problems that eventually will end up with more efficient, more resource-friendly data centers and approaches to AI generally?
I think we have to look at where regulation is headed. And the idea that we are opening up federal land to data center construction and reducing environmental protections and permitting processes, that there's an attempt to expedite in the name of things like national security and innovation, of course. But that means that the communities that are going to be dealing with the immediate effects of data center construction are not really being consulted at all. And again, may not really be aware of what the impacts will be. So looking at things like air pollution related to the natural gas that is actually being used to power a lot of these data centers, because there isn't sufficient renewable energy. And one of the other problems that we see here is that there's this future orientation and a discussion about things like small modular reactors and other kinds of technologies that don't quite exist in reality yet. And yet the energy sources that are right now powering data centers are overwhelmingly upholding the fossil fuel industry. And so we are moving further away from emissions targets that we desperately need to hit in order to save ourselves collectively. The health impacts of data centers are something that really have not been studied very in depth, right? So we have more reporting on the energy consumption related to data centers. We might have more information about their water consumption or the emissions connected to them. But that doesn't necessarily translate into how local populations are dealing with things like asthma rates that are going up, or dealing with pollution from wastewater, or dealing with the loss of agricultural land or public parks because of transmission lines. And so I think part of the problem is that a data center is also this thing that can appear to be an economic boon for communities. It may be a source of jobs or financial stimulation at a time when a lot of towns really need that. But there really aren't very many jobs attached to a data center. It is, in many ways, a concrete box full of servers. It is not a factory. It is not providing a lot of people in an area with jobs necessarily. And in many cases, as GoodJobs first found, the subsidies that data center operators are being given are pulling away tax revenue from local places. You have less money from your taxes for things like public schools or transportation, and more money is going back to companies like Amazon.
I want to put you all in conversation with each other to some extent. I wish we could have everybody who participated in this series on the podcast, but that would be a chorus of voices, and I don't think the listener would necessarily be able to make much sense of it. But I want to ask you each to perhaps reflect on something you maybe learned from one of your colleagues as part of this series, or some insight that perhaps, you know, affected the way you approached, you know, the work that you're doing going forward. I just kind of go around the room and see if there's something that, each of you might care to respond to. But Jacob, perhaps I'll start with you.
Sure. I mean, that's a great question. And I'll take this opportunity to thank all the other authors. I guess I'll express a particular appreciation for the two pieces on labor. So Luca Belli and Natalia Luca. That's not my area of expertise. So I'm always eager to learn more from experts in that space. But thinking through the ways in which, a lot of these changes are essentially driven by Silicon Valley's perpetual abhorrence of labor. This idea that human labor is pointless or it's a hassle, right? The fact that you have to have workers means that you yourself have less power. And so much of Silicon Valley's ideology, the products they make, their relation with their own workers, their relation with workers from their customers, right? It is all oriented towards around sort of demeaning the human. And the way that they make their money on demeaning the human is by taking away our right to receive compensation for the work we do and the expertise we have. And both Natalia's article is a little more oriented towards labor in general, and then Luca Belli's article is more oriented towards tech labor, he himself being previously employed at Twitter and being sort of one of the last ones out the door on their from their responsible AI team that was so impressive before Elon came in. Yeah, I find that the theme between those two is really about, understanding this ideology of both sort of disliking the very idea of human labor, but also seeing it as the key opportunity for accumulating more and more resources and power at the top of the tech industry, and how that finds a sympathetic ear within the Trump administration that sort of imagines, the future of the U.S. industry is all of our children putting screws in iPhones, and not as scientists, not as engineers, not as, intellects or artists or writers, right? But rather as cogs, increasingly digital cogs.
I really appreciated the full collection. But I was particularly happy to see the piece by Brian Chen, Tina Park, and now it's Kasterneck, which focused on the military uses of AI. And I think it's something that people might be tacitly aware of, but it is really great to have a piece calling out those very strong relationships between AI and also our participation in using AI and its connection to military applications. And it's great to have people writing about that in an outlet like Tech Policy Press, kind of reiterating maybe some of the points that groups like No Tech for Apartheid might make, but in a very different context. And I think that is very useful right now.
I'll head on to just real quick, because I think both are really interesting to me. Reem's piece, I think, is fascinating to me because prior to being an attorney, I worked in social services as an outreach worker to unhoused people. And at the time, this is the early 2000s, everybody was like, oh, if we could just get data so that we know when one person goes to the shelter and another person goes to get a free meal and another person goes to the clinic or the day treatment, like we can understand what somebody's life is actually like so we can craft better solutions to help them, right? And it was so data in this guise of like doing the public good. And I think Reem's piece and the co-authors helped to turn that into that on its head and understand this is a Trojan horse, right? Like whatever the kind of ostensibly good reasons are for data collection can easily be perverted you know, and this has been true for many communities, particularly communities of color, for a long time. But I think on the massive scale at which it's happening when the U.S. government decides to do it, I think is really, really eye-opening, that Trojan horse and like the importance viscerally of privacy concerns. The other thing I think was really great was Ben's piece on government use of AI to show that this is not just that this technology that's being hyped up, overhyped so vigorously, isn't going to solve a lot of the basic problems of governance, right? It's a hustle, and government now is becoming the biggest client, and that's how they're sustaining themselves. And in a way, it looks like, you know, probably just the standard business practices of every major industry over the long haul, but in this new packaged form, and really calling into question the notion that it's going to do any of the things that the people who are hyping it up actually claim that it can do. And in fact, it might end up just being entrenching a lot of really bad, damaging, problematic practices and technology in the long run.
I think several of the pieces talk about the hype related to AI. I think, Tamara, your piece touches on it, as well as Dr. Alex Hennen, Emily Bender's piece. And I think the thing that's very useful in thinking through some of those, the breakdowns in both of your pieces, is it really solidifies like this idea that we're making these massive, massive investments, including, you know, in the Brian Chen and Tina Parks article in terms of military investment and in terms of the infrastructure, right? And it's based on, there's very little evidence to show that it's going to pay off, right? And we are having regulation thwarted because of this, right? We are having, you know, other sorts of high priority things, money redirected away from that in hope that this bet will pay off. And I think it's very helpful, particularly as somebody who is not a technologist, to hear this coming from technologists and breaking down, you know, exactly what some of the myths are behind what this technology can and can't do. And I think one of the things, I don't know that it was specifically addressed in the theories, but, you know, coming back to the idea of researchers, right, and the ability to scrutinize these systems, I think it's also one issue that I've been thinking about in parallel to this that connects to what we're trying to do in the series, is just how difficult it is for people to study some of these claims. Like, we don't have a way of looking under the hood of these things to see whether, you know, the label on the product actually does what it says it does. We don't have that sort of government capacity either in terms of having like an FDA equivalent for some of this tech. And that's something that we've struggled with significantly in Oakland, right? When we're getting these vendors pitching us, we're often told that they have these amazing capacities, but everything's proprietary. So you have no way of actually, you know, scrutinizing and knowing whether they're being truthful or not. And oftentimes, like, I think how something is marketed, it's very, very different than how it actually plays out. And so there's something very similar here that has come up in multiple pieces around the false promise of AI or AGI. And that resonated incredibly deeply with some of the previous iterations of tech that we've been trying to regulate here in Oakland.
Jacob, you and Meg Young at Data and Society, as well as, I should say, other teammates on the Data Society team who helped to pull this together, both logistically and handle things like graphics and social media. This was a process, and it was a great experiment. We were very pleased at Tech Policy Press to participate in it. But what did you learn? And what could you say about the nature of pulling together this transdisciplinary team?
I'll extend my thanks specifically to our director of research, Alice Marwick, our executive director, Janet Haven, and our engagements and networking teams. Part of the inspiration for this is just having an opportunity to think together, right? To write together. It's a collaboration between academics, journalists, lawyers, social workers, tech workers, a very broad range of people who all kind of share the same concerns, the same passions, and it was good to get together and to work on it, which I would also, you know, extend my thank you to you, Justin, and the rest of your team at TPP for, you know, helping us have a venue that could work quickly and putting out these pieces.
I'm grateful to each of you, both for the conversation today and for your contributions to this series, which is called Ideologies of Control, a series on tech power and democratic crisis. If you Google that phrase along with Tech Policy Press, I'm sure you'll find it, or use the browser, I should say, of your choice. But Kevin, Reem, Tamara, Jacob, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks, Justin.
That's it for this episode. I hope you'll send your feedback. You can write to me at justin@techpolicy.press. Thanks to our collaborators at Data and Society. Thanks to my co-founder, Brian Jones. And thank you for listening.
Tech Policy Press.